It's the Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Next week at this time, and every Friday hence, WESA will present Politics with Amy Walter on The Takeaway. It's a new addition to your morning programming, one that WESA hopes will help unravel headlines and trends in national politics ahead of what's guaranteed to be a busy election year. Host Amy Walter joins us from the Capitol. Amy, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
And with me in studio is the editor of WESA's Government and Accountability Team, Chris Potter. Hey there, Chris.
Hey, Kevin.
So we're 52 weeks out. How much does crossing this one-year mark affect how you cover critical issues and even the mood of the nation? Amy, let's start with you.
Well, you are right. In some ways, we have a very long way to go before the election. And in some ways, it's creeping right up on us. It's less than 100 days before the Iowa caucuses. So what we're watching right now is for how those choices are being shaped by a whole bunch of things. What's happening in Washington, what they're seeing from the candidates themselves, what they're seeing coming out of the White House, and what that is going to mean for states that vote a little bit later in the process, like Pennsylvania.
Yeah. Chris, what about here in Pennsylvania?
Yeah, I mean, 52 weeks out, but I'm already laying in the extra supply of bourbon, so I think that lets you know kind of where my head is at. But, you know, I mean, I think a lot of Western Pennsylvania in particular, as this kind of swingy area, as the kind of place that sort of stands in for all those communities that had been reliably Democratic but surprised the world by turning out for Donald Trump in 2016. So you're already kind of thinking about this stuff. Just earlier this week, the mayor of Pittsburgh, Bill Peduto, basically intimated that he was not a fan of further petrochemical employers coming into the region because of environmental concerns. That has touched off a huge backlash among some circles, including organized labor. A lot of those questions that used to be, you know, kind of policy driven and what kind of region do we have now also have this whole extra layer of political charge to them.
Mm-hmm. But what's dominated the news this week and in prior weeks has been talk of impeachment. And it's been a focus of several of your recent programs, Amy. How do you expect repercussions from the impeachment process to play themselves out?
Yeah, we're watching that very closely right now. And what we've seen overall is that Americans, not surprisingly, are about as divided on impeachment as they are opinions of the president. What I think is fascinating, though, and I've been writing about this for a while and can't wait to talk about this on the show, but how those key battleground states, Pennsylvania, of course, being one of them, think about this issue can look different from how it looks nationally. So we get a lot of national polls, but the polls that I really want to see and the conversations I really want to have are with people who are in the places that are going to decide the presidential election. Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Michigan, Arizona, Florida, all of them are going to play an outsized role. And we've seen some data come back that suggests that support for impeachment in those places, those sorts of states, not as high as it is nationally.
Chris, what's the temperature here in Western Pennsylvania regarding impeachment?
I can't speak in any kind of anything beyond an anecdotal sense of that. I will say there was just a poll out from Franklin and Marshall College. They do a lot of statewide polling, which said I think that something like 57% of Pennsylvanians were in support of the inquiry, of continuing the inquiry. That's not to say they're in favor of, you know, removal at the end of the day, but continuing through with it. I would say here in Western Pennsylvania, where the sort of early symptoms of this thing percolating up really is in our congressional delegation here, specifically Connor Lamb, elected as a sort of moderate from a very kind of swingy district in the suburban and rural areas outside of Pittsburgh. He is now facing, as of this week, just a couple days ago, Sean Parnell, a frequent guest on Fox News and a champion of the president. He just jumped into the race and he has come out swinging, accusing Connor Lamb, as Connor Lamb has been accused before, of marching in lockstep with Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats. He has often actually taken votes, has Connor Lamb, against the Democratic position. But when it comes to impeachment, you can see where this is headed.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Our guests are WESA's Chris Potter and Amy Walter, host of the Takeaways Friday News Roundup, Politics with Amy Walter. WESA is bringing the Takeaway on Fridays into its programming schedule beginning next week. Amy, you've been discussing on your program whether the impeachment process might spur more Republicans to run for office. We heard Chris talk about the challengers to Conor Lamb, or maybe even help the GOP win back some House seats that were lost in 18. What's your sense of whether either or both may actually come to pass?
So we haven't seen yet a bunch of Republican candidates say, boy, this impeachment vote, that's the thing that got me into the race. But I think if you're looking in districts where the president is either popular or that he carried by a pretty decent amount in 2016, those are the sorts of places where Republicans are going to use the Democrats' impeachment proceedings against the Democratic incumbent, regardless of how that person votes ultimately on an impeachment, and want to make that sort of a defining issue. The problem right now, of course, is we just don't know how many more twists and turns we're going to hit before we get to 2020.
You mentioned the swing states, some of them by name. For instance, in 2016, Donald Trump won Pennsylvania by 44,000 votes, Wisconsin 23,000, Michigan, I believe, is just 11,000. To each of you, what's going to be your approach to covering swing states in the weeks and months ahead? Amy?
A lot of it is actually going there. So I want to go, you know, Western Pennsylvania, obviously very important, has always been, as well as the northeastern part of the state in and around Scranton and Wilkes-Barre that, you know, traditionally had voted for Democrats, voted for Obama. And then in 2016, the bottom just fell out for Democrats and Trump really overperformed what even the most optimistic Republicans expected.
Chris, Donald Trump planted a flag for Trump country in Western Pennsylvania. Hillary Clinton won Allegheny County 56-40%, but he had large margins in surrounding counties, Beaver, Butler, Lawrence, Westmoreland, you just name it. So how do you explore whether there's still strength in what had been Trump country?
Yeah, I mean, that's the big question, right? Because on the one hand, you want to tell the story about what's happening in those communities. And the news, frankly, is not always all that great. Some reporting from my colleague Lucy Perkins here, some of the Trump tariffs, for example, have helped some steel producers, and it was this is the whole point of this, to help the steel industry, but a lot of others who import the steel and produce finished products out of it have been hurt by the tariffs. There have been layoffs taking place in Western Pennsylvania, in the heart of this area where, as you say, he kind of planted his flag. One of the things I kind of hope to do, and I think it's a part of the equation that often gets left out here, is those voters who are, you know, they vote Democratic. It's not really a question about whether they're going who they're going to vote for, but whether they're going to show up to vote at all. And so we talk so much about the sort of the white working class in industrial, post-industrial, rural areas or whatever. But there are a lot of African American voters in Philadelphia, of course. But it's closer to me. It's just a one zone bus ride for me to get into, you know, the city of Pittsburgh and neighborhoods where the strength of the turnout in 2008 and 2012 gave Democrats the White House. But a lot of those voters were, frankly, not as excited about Hillary Clinton as I think Democrats were expecting. We also want to be sure that we're looking at the folks who are close to home and who the Democrats need to keep close to home.
Amy, are you going to be focusing on any particular voting groups, or do we make a mistake by lumping people into voting groups?
We do shorthand it because it helps us to make sense of, you know, it's a pretty complicated and big event, series of events, right? Millions and millions of people all voting at one time. So to sort of help us make some sense of why or who supports different kinds of candidates, I'm okay with that. A group of voters, I do think, that got a lot of attention in 2018 will be important. Suburban, mostly white, upper to upper middle class, college educated, in and around major metro areas, Pittsburgh and Philadelphia. But I think a very important group to watch this year in places like Pennsylvania will be the white women who are not four-year college degree holders. And Chris's point about younger voters of color especially is going to be important. I don't think we spent enough time in 2016 really appreciating how cynical and turned off they were by both of the candidates and by the Democratic nomination process.
Twitter CEO announced Thursday they will no longer accept political ads. Jack Dorsey cited the ads, saying they carry, quote, significant risk to politics. Do you think Twitter alone will have much of an impact by social media on the election?
It's going to be, I think, for voters, really, really challenging to be able to distinguish between truth and fiction, things that you're seeing on your social media feeds that you should trust and not trust. And that's kind of the whole point of the show, the Politics with Amy Walter show, which is we try to cut through all of that stuff to get you right at the fundamentals, the structural challenges, rather than, you know, getting caught up in whatever the social media debate is at that moment or the scandal of that moment it is. It's let's cut through all of that. Is this true? Is this not true? What do we know?
Yeah, I just say in terms of the social media, I think the Twitter experiment, this decision to not take political ads is interesting. My kind of gut sense here, though, is that the bigger driver of this phenomenon is Facebook, which has, let's just say, not taken such a strong position there. And I think that is something that not just Amy on her program, but all of us journalists are really going to have to reckon with. We've all had the experience of people coming out of the blue and saying, well, you don't know about the Pizzagate conspiracy or whatever it is, and sort of having to address this stuff, which piles up almost faster than you can dig out from under it. And that's going to be a challenge for us in the media and for you out there in the world.
And no matter how we hear about them, the field is still remarkably crowded. Amy, Chris, in our remaining seconds, take a guesstimate for me. How many candidates will still be in the race by Iowa? That's about 3 months away. What do you think?
I don't know. I think 10 to 12 sounds about right. It may be maybe closer to the 10.
I got no idea, but I will say this. Don't complain about it. I remember in 2016, so many people like, oh, I wish we had more choices. Then when you get a bunch of choices, everybody's like, there's too many choices. These are good candidates on the Democratic side. There are strong candidates on the Republican side. You know, you get to choose here. Pay attention and be glad that you have this opportunity.
Chris Potter is WESA's Government and Accountability Editor. Chris, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Amy Walter is the host of The Takeaways, Politics with Amy Walter. You'll hear it at this time every Friday through the 2020 election. Amy, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Kevin.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Kylie Kaczynski, still ahead on The Confluence. Manufacturing is among the top industries in terms of jobs in Pennsylvania. We're nearing a retirement boom across the sector, and some fear there could be a hiring crisis. And a bioterror attack, which weaponizes viruses, bacteria, and other germs, can reach far more people across a larger area than a traditional terror attack. So what's being done to prevent or defend against them? You can find conversations, stories, and more from this and past episodes of the show on our website at wesa.fm/confluence. The Confluence continues next on 90.5 WESA.
Here's what's trending in Pittsburgh. I'm Ariel Worthy. Two cranes and 12 hours later, a city bus was free from a giant hole. During Monday morning rush hour, a sinkhole opened underneath a city bus. The rear of the vehicle was stuck in the hole and required two cranes to be lifted out. Officials say repairs for the street could take up to 8 weeks. And a traveling code-a-thon is headed to CMU to help develop technology for first responders. Cash prizes will be awarded to the winning teams, and attendees with any level of coding experience can participate. For more stories, go to WESA.fm.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. President Trump promised his tariffs on imported steel would revitalize U.S. steel producers, but the policy has had the opposite effect for some mills in western Pennsylvania. In the steel town of Farrell, workers at NLMK USA are living through drastic work reductions. 90.5 WESA's Lucy Perkins talked with one steelworker about his experience.
My name's James Wells. I'm the unit president for Local 101603 at NLMK Farrell. I've been here for 20 years. I'm an electrician off the pickle line, and we take steel slabs and we convert them into steel coil.
Wells has seen a lot in his decades on the pickle line, where steel is treated to remove impurities. I asked him if he's seen any of the benefits the Trump administration's promised in its trade policy.
Not really, not. There's not a lot I can really say about that.
For years, the mill bought steel slab from overseas and converted it to steel coil in Pennsylvania. That coil eventually ends up in household appliances like refrigerators and dishwashers. But the Trump administration's tariffs on imported steel made that business model much more expensive. NLMK lost $160 million in 2018 alone.
The economy just isn't there.
Wells represents about 430 union steelworkers, and he says about half of his membership has gone through an on-again, off-again layoff process.
We've had a couple different layoffs here recently because of business conditions being slow. You know, week layoff, that means they're laid off for the week, you know, because of the business conditions, but yet there's enough business that you actually can bring them back for another week. It all depends on the business and the orders.
Companies hurt by the tariffs can request an exemption, but the process takes a long time, and there's no guarantee you'll get one. NLMK asked to be exempt from tariffs on 85 products. The government denied every one. Here's why. In order to get an exemption, you have to show that you can't get the steel from a U.S. company. And other producers said they did have the steel NLMK needed, but they never said they'd sell it to them. Because why would you sell steel to your own competition? Jim Wells is critical of the administration's tariffs and the trade war in its entirety.
This trade war and tariffs that's going back and forth isn't helping anybody, in my personal opinion.
And so when you have, you know, local meetings, what's the mood like? Are people frustrated? Are people hopeful that things will change soon?
Everybody's frustrated. Yeah, everybody's frustrated over it all. And now that the whole economy's all slowed down and 1 week you're laid off, the next you're not, yeah, they're worried. They're definitely worried about it. And there's nothing that we can tell them right at this point in time that can help change any of that.
Wells acknowledges that this has happened before. Business also slowed down in the 2008 recession.
The steel industry has always been an up and down industry. 2008, we slowed down. Well, then everything picked back up and we were back to doing it again, 6-7 days a week, working all the time. And well, now here we are again, the economy's slow, so everything slowed down again.
Farrell's in Mercer County, which voted for Trump by more than 20 percentage points. I asked if the tariffs have impacted how anyone at the mill feels about President Trump.
I won't get into the politics like that. I can't do that.
But he did have a message for the Trump administration and policymakers.
Make the tariffs go away and actually put things back to the way they were so everybody ain't got to worry about their jobs. Quit with the trade war and let's go back to doing things the way we're supposed to.
I'm Lucy Perkins, 90.5 WESA News.
And I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Manufacturing is the second largest industry in terms of jobs in Pennsylvania. The sector increasingly requires workers to be skilled in math and science, and ahead of a retirement boom, some fear there could be a hiring crisis. As Keystone Crossroads contributor Robbie Broad reports, a new state grant aims to bridge the divide between classrooms and the needs of local industry.
In Matthew Durr's Discovery Classroom, third graders are learning about the science of weather. Today's lesson is tornadoes. In small groups, the students can see how the storms develop using augmented reality technology. As they view their desks through the screen of a tablet, a tornado appears. It swirls right before their eyes, with cows and fences blowing through the air. Durr teaches at Whitfield Elementary School in Berks County. He says having access to cutting-edge technology gives kids a hands-on way to learn complex concepts.
We roll in a cart of cell phones that are virtual reality and augmented reality, and the classes are just super excited. They're asking, when are we doing this again? Because they want to see things, but they also want to learn more.
This technology was made possible through a new state grant program that promotes better education in STEM. That's science, technology, engineering, and math. The state estimates that most jobs created in the next decade will require workers to use computers, and many opportunities will be STEM-related. But there's a problem.
Math.
Dan Fogarty is director of workforce development in Berks County, where there's an especially large disconnect between the needs of the local economy and the amount of skilled workers. And math is a skill, Fogarty says, is lacking.
That's really important, is to not take your eyes off the math foundation. Because you can have an interest in these areas, but if you're not proficient quantitatively, you're probably not going to be successful in these fields.
In Berks, manufacturing is the largest industry, with jobs that increasingly require high-level STEM skills.
Some of the best practitioners of trigonometry are precision machinists. Sometimes they're actually better than people who teach math, because if you drill the hole in the wrong spot on the $7,000 part and it has to be scrapped, you probably don't get to do that twice.
But as is the case across the state, in Berks, the workforce is aging out of the occupation. In the next 5 years, the county estimates it will need to hire 7,000 new employees to maintain the current workforce level. Will the students of today be ready? Well, Fogarty is worried. He says local schools are not especially well matched with the opportunities available, and says there's a larger cultural problem.
That numeracy is really important, and unfortunately in this country, that's one that hasn't gotten enough focus. Our students going through the K-12 system are not keeping pace with their peers internationally in math. And that's going to limit their career trajectory in STEM occupations.
The new state grant has allowed the county to purchase a robust technology lending library, start a STEM-focused summer camp, and give teachers more training. It's also put money behind plans to strengthen partnerships between schools and local industry. Charles Travato is a leader in the Berks County Intermediate Unit, which facilitates the grant for districts in the county.
What we're seeing is more experiences come out of this, more partnership, collaboration, conversations with our workforce, which we haven't seen before.
I hope we can see it drop.
Back at Whitfield Elementary, parent Erin Allred says she's seen how the school's focus on STEM and discovery classrooms have changed the way her children think.
Legos and Kinects and things like that aren't just toys anymore. Like, they're tools to solve problems and build bridges and just concepts that they've, the computational thinking, the architectural thinking, abstractly, things that they've learned in discovery class.
So far, the success of the program is only anecdotal. It'll take years before we can measure the true impact. Robbie Broad, Keystone Crossroads.
And I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. When we hear the term bioterrorism, we might logically think of the intentional release of some toxic virus or bacteria. But researchers continue to develop ways to tap into biological resources to produce food, energy, and industrial goods. But there are those who would twist that technology to create a deadly threat. I spoke earlier this week with Andy Pickett. He is the Bureau of Public Health Preparedness Director, and Ray Barashansky. He's Pennsylvania's Deputy Secretary for Health Preparedness and Community Protection. Ray, Andy, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having us here.
In early October, the Governor's Office of Homeland Security and Pennsylvania Department of Health sponsored a conference about bioterrorism that brought together more than 700 professionals, doctors, nurses, public health officials, EMS workers, police, firefighters. Andy, I want to start with you. How does the Department of Health define bioterrorism?
So bioterrorism is any intentional act that would release a biological agent, a bacteria, a virus, a spore, you know, into an area that could affect, you know, could potentially affect the population in a negative way.
Has what is considered to be bioterrorism expanded in recent years? Has it evolved?
So I think the evolution is not so much in what is or isn't bioterrorism, but the types of agents, the fact that, you know, we think of things like smallpox, which has been eradicated, and yet there's this lingering suspicion that it could be used as a bioterrorism agent. There are other diseases that are circulating around the world, for example, Ebola in Africa, which could be leveraged by a nefarious actor and utilized in a way to affect the population here.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned Ebola as a possibility, smallpox. Are there other toxins that you consider big threats at this time?
You know, I don't know if it's big threats or small threats. You know, anthrax is certainly one that is a high consequence, although a low probability type event. But there have even been examples of more mundane diseases. For example, botulism, which was actually used in a biological attack here in the United States, I believe about 30 years ago, where samples were sprinkled on a salad bar in a restaurant.
Mm-hmm. So to either Ray or Andy, how are those agents detected? What is the process for spotting them and determining what they are?
It's really not a single process, but rather a multi-step process. So part of that deals with our Bureau of Epidemiology and the syndromic surveillance that they're consistently under, that they're undergoing. Part of it deals with our consistent communication with hospitals and other community partners in regard to the clinical picture that they are seeing. And part of that deals with our Bureau of Laboratories and the robust nature of the threats that they test for. In regard to the laboratories, even though we don't think about it like this, they're testing for things like measles and mumps every day. So when they see something that's unusual, it also calls for us to marshal our efforts here at the Department of Health and have Andy step in to really play the quarterback, for lack of a better term. And then we either push out what we're seeing to our partners at the Center for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta, or even other entities such as other states that could potentially be impacted.
Right. Let me follow up on that. So give us a scenario or an idea of how the process works. How is the Bureau of Labs alerted, and then what is the step they take?
Well, it's important to remember that public health emergencies are not like traditional emergencies. Nobody is pulling up with an ambulance, a fire engine, or a police car with lights and sirens going. Sometimes these public health emergencies are slowly emerging, and sometimes they emerge in a quicker way and all have certain clinical symptomology that we'll see. So we oftentimes hear from a hospital or another concerned healthcare partner in the community who says, I've seen this particular type of symptomology. I'm seeing this particular a cluster of something. And automatically here at the department, we move into what we call incident command mode. So that's where the Bureau of Public Health Preparedness works on an even closer basis, sometimes meeting daily or even weekly with our Bureau of Epidemiology, the Bureau of Communicable Disease, the communications folks, and even other areas. And one of those critical partners is our Bureau of Laboratories. So that public health laboratory is always there monitoring certain tests on a regular basis, but they can also ramp up or ramp down depending on the specific situation. So to give you an example, right now I believe that they are testing for various things within the Commonwealth, and anything that causes us a measure of concern, as I said, we push over to the CDC as well, so that A, they can confirm our tests, but B, we can also make the federal authorities aware of any public health threats.
Our guests on The Confluence are Andy Pickett, Bureau of Public Health Preparedness Director, and Ray Barashansky, Deputy Secretary for Health Preparedness and Community Protection. Are any of the newer dangers more difficult to detect?
No, certainly in the 21st century, we're dealing with a ever-changing threat environment, and the threats surrounding bioterrorism are no different. You know, biomedical technologies are evolving. What nefarious actors can do is certainly increasing and could potentially make it make diseases more lethal, can make them harder to detect, harder to treat. And so that is something we need to be aware of.
I think it actually should be noted that the Commonwealth does get an federal funding that speaks specifically to public health preparedness. And one of the areas that we utilize that funding for is making sure that we exercise, plan, and train for biological agents like the ones that we're speaking about right now.
So what is the process of that training and so that you are on the top of your game, if you would?
So, you know, it's a cyclical process of planning, training, exercising, and evaluating. We recognize that there are a number of threats. So when we plan, we try to plan in an all hazards way. So it doesn't matter what threat we're dealing with, whether it's a fire, a flood, a biological agent, a pandemic influenza, we as a department are able to respond to that. So we have a wide array of plans for different situations, but really the core of how we respond is the same. We ensure that our internal Department of Health staff are trained on those plans, able to fill those incident response roles, and then we practice those plans. Actually, today we are on day two of a four-day full-scale exercise where the Department of Health, our federal partners, other state agencies, and several local health department partners in the southeast portion of the state are currently going through the motions of what we would do if there was a bioterrorism event in the Philadelphia region.
Do you do these kind of things often?
You know, we perform various levels of exercises. Sometimes it's a small exercise with key decision makers sitting around a conference room table, just talking through how we will respond. Sometimes we ramp it up, and in this case, it is a full-scale exercise where we're actually moving people, resources, equipment, having those real-time communications and coordination between the different levels of government, and really practicing in an almost real-world event what that end result would be like.
Ray, the impact of bioterrorism can be greater than a traditional terror attack like a shooting, since it can affect thousands of people across a large area in a short time, depending on what is attacked, a water system, a food supply, or something like that. Is that particularly concerning, the fact that the potential victims can be large and that you're sort of reacting to rather than averting?
Well, there are several programs in place, which I have to be a little nebulous about, and I apologize for that, which are constantly monitoring things like air supply and water supply for agents such as just the ones that we're speaking about. But at the same time, knowing that our local, state, and federal authorities are literally always prepared for events like this actually do make me feel a little bit better. Yes, the impact of events like this can be widespread, and at the same time, they can strike suddenly. But we do have systems in place both to monitor our air and water supplies for things just like this, and we've planned and planned and planned and trained and trained and trained and exercised for events just like this.
Mm-hmm. Andy, what are you doing to improve, in addition to the tabletop exercises and other full-blown exercises, to maybe improve the overall response by not only the department, but the partners that you have mentioned, whether it's hospitals and others, you know, improving the communications even?
You know, like I said before, it's really a cyclical process where after those exercises, we will identify the gaps. We will identify the things that didn't work the way we think they should have. And we're able to take that information and from there inform our future planning and training efforts. So each time we go through that iterative cycle, we're getting better. And we really rely on our community partners. We have great relationships with the local health jurisdictions in Pennsylvania. We work through seven different healthcare coalitions, which are the healthcare sector, hospitals, EMS, doctor's offices, working together to prepare for disasters, to prepare for emergencies. So we have really built up these community partnerships, these ground level efforts, so that we have good coordination and that we continue to strengthen that as we go through these iterative cycles.
Is there any concern that the more partners you have, that there can be sort of a momentary lapse, some sort of breakdown in communication?
You know, certainly every incident, every exercise, communication is often one of the biggest challenges. We have systems in place, telephone, email, radio systems, web-based information sharing platforms, and we always know that sometimes something might not happen the way we want it to, but that's why we continually practice and we continually strive to improve both internally and externally with our partners to make sure that when the real event happens, we're able to minimize that as much as possible.
Ray, from a community perspective, what are some steps that individuals can take to prepare, combat the spread of bioterror, a bioterror incident? Can individuals do anything?
One of the things that we often tell individuals to do is to have their own personal preparedness kit at home. And I believe that all preparedness does actually start on the individual level. So whether that involves having water or, you know, dried foods stored, or even extra medication or things just like that, those are important steps toward your personal preparedness. But I also always tell people to make sure to check with reputable news sources when thinking about or in the middle of any emergency. So typically I tell people to go to the CDC's website when you're looking at a public health emergency. That is the definitive news source, and that's where you need to be getting your information from. Clearly the State Department of Health website is also consistently pushing out public messaging also in regard to emergencies. And I think that you made a very valuable point about community preparedness, because as I've often seen in my career, and I believe Andy has seen the same thing, if your community is prepared, it really allows us to have an easier, never easy, but easier job when responding to emergencies, large-scale emergencies, such as the ones that we're discussing. But when the community doesn't really understand what's going on and hasn't really prepared in advance, you're at a bit of a loss. You really have to start from step one.
Final question to each of you. What is your level of concern about a potential bioterror attack, a wide-scale emergency? Andy, let's start with you.
You know, what we're talking about are what we consider high-consequence, low-probability events. And so we really don't think this is too likely, but if it were ever to happen, it would have a significant impact on the community, on the population, on human health, on the economy. And so really those impacts are massive. So I'm not going to say it keeps me up at night, but it's certainly something that we continue to prepare for and be ready for. And, you know, certainly pray and hope that it doesn't happen, but know that we're going to take steps so that if it does happen, we're ready for it.
Ray, let me ask you this. At the conference that was held in Pittsburgh in October, U.S. Attorney Scott Brady mentioned that the threat matrix for the next couple of years predicts that bioterror is a very real issue. What is your level of concern about a potential bioterror attack?
So when I first became involved with public health preparedness, I was speaking with an associate from the CDC, and we were speaking about mass dispensing of antibiotics and antivirals, depending on the situation. And one of the things he said to me has stuck with me for a long time. And what he said was, if you devise the system well, you'll be able to push out whatever you want through that system. It could be antibiotics, it could be antivirals, it could be flu shots. Devise a system around your capabilities and your capacity. I look at that lesson and I try to expound on it in regard to our state of public health preparedness here in the Commonwealth. We've devised systems through our planning, through our overall preparedness efforts, exercising, and training. And those systems are robust. They involve community partners. They involve our hospitals. They involve healthcare coalitions. They involve other entities, both at the state level and federal levels. As long as those systems are robust, and as long as we have pushed out as much messaging as we could, both to our partners and to the public, we can adapt those systems to whatever threat comes our way.
Ray Barashansky is Deputy Secretary for Health Preparedness and Community Protection, and Andy Pickett is the Bureau of Public Health Preparedness Director. Thanks, gentlemen, for taking the time today.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
And for today, that's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, there are about 20,000 women veterans living in western Pennsylvania. A new project helps tell the story of women veterans who often feel invisible as service members. And the NCAA has decided to allow college athletes to benefit from their names and images. Does that mean they can get direct cash for endorsements? If you missed anything from today's program, or you would like to catch up on past shows, please visit wesa.fm/confluence or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski, production assistance from Julia Zenkovic. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good weekend of good news.